From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, new testimony in the case of Darrell Jones, convicted of murder 30 years ago, but claims he's innocent amidst allegations that the jury was racially biased.
And I said, how come you have a decision already? I said, is it because he's black? And they said, yes. They said, yes.
Also today, the debate over doing away with English-only education in Massachusetts public schools. Plus, George Ween, founder of the Newport Jazz Festival, recalls the summer of 1955 when Miles Davis stole the show.
I was in a club in New York. Walking out of the club, Miles is there. And he says, George, you're going to have a jazz festival this year? I says, yes. He says, well, you can't have a festival without me, Miles says.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're going to begin today with a troubling question that is too often asked about the criminal justice system. Did it send the wrong man to jail? Supporters of Darrell Jones say in his case the answer is yes. Jones was convicted of murder 30 years ago, but insists he is innocent and is seeking a new trial. He was convicted back in 1986, even though he didn't match the description of the murderer. Not a single eyewitness could identify him in the courtroom, and a key piece of evidence was allegedly tampered with. Furthermore, one of the jurors in the case claims that the jury was racially biased against Jones because he was black. WBUR's senior reporter Bruce Gellerman has been following this story, including dramatic testimony in a Fall River courtroom yesterday. And Bruce joins us now. Good to have you, Bruce.
Thank you, Anthony.
So there was this hearing yesterday in Fall River. But tell us first about the juror who you tracked down, who's made a pretty dramatic claim about jury bias more than 30 years ago.
Let me explain here. In yesterday's hearing, essentially, Anthony, the original jury was on trial. Lawyers before, during, and after a trial can't contact jurors. I was originally investigating this case, and it seems reporters can, and so I did. I went down the jury list and from the 1986 trial, and the first one I found on the list was Eleanor Urbati. I called her up. I went to her house and just kind of turned on my recorder, and she started telling me about the case, that after 9 days of trial testimony, the jury began deliberations. And she said at the very start, the jurors took a poll. It was an all-white jury, and most said that Jones was innocent. But according to her body, two men said they thought that Jones was guilty.
And I said, how come you have a decision already? I said, is it because he's black? And they said, yes. They said, yes, the two men. How do you like that? I remember this like it was yesterday. I don't know how, but I do. That's exactly what they said.
So Darrell Jones's attorney seized on this because earlier this year, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that racial discrimination by jurors can be grounds for a new trial. And so his lawyers filed a motion asking the judge to hold a hearing and quiz the original jurors.
Interesting. So did this come up at yesterday's hearing in Fall River?
Yeah, the lawyers found 8 jurors and they sent them summonses and 3 showed up, but here's the thing, Anthony, not Urbati.
Not Urbati, the woman we just heard from.
Right. And of course, her testimony, you know, could have been pivotal to the defense.
So what happened? Why didn't she show up in court, or why wasn't she summoned, or was she summoned?
Well, she seems to have been summoned. It's a very good question. After the hearing yesterday, I called her up and she told me she never got a summons to appear. But the defense attorneys tell me they, in fact, did send her one. But remember, they can't directly deal with her. They can't contact her directly. They can't talk to her. So, you know, it's you know, who knows why she didn't show up.
Interesting. So what about the other jurors who did show up? Did any of them confirm what Urbati told you about the jury's racial, the alleged racial bias of the jury?
Well, no. They're all elderly. Three decades, you know, memories fade. And even when it comes to something as important as being a juror in a first-degree murder trial. Anthony, here's an exchange between one of the original jurors. Her name was Maureen Bates. She had to be helped to the witness stand by bailiffs. She's elderly. And she spoke with Judge McGuire.
Do you remember pretty well?
I don't really remember.
I've been trying to go through this in my mind.
Sure.
I don't remember any. I remember sitting there, but I don't remember. My memory isn't right. Like.
No, that's
like
fine.
It used to
it's been
be.
A long time.
It has.
It's been a long time. Now, it's important to point out here that this whole subject about possible jury bias came up because of your reporting, Bruce. So well done there.
Thanks.
But originally, this hearing was supposed to be about a key piece of evidence that had been allegedly doctored. Remind us what this is about.
Exactly. This was the fourth day. It was supposed to be a two-day hearing that was limited to this crucial piece of evidence from the original trial. It was really the piece that sealed Darrell Jones's fate. It was a videotape made by a police detective as he interviewed an eyewitness to the murder. The tape had a bizarre edit right in the middle, right at the most dramatic part where she's telling, you know, the sergeant what she saw. There's a scene from Sergeant Bilko from the 1950s Army sitcom.
How strange.
Bizarre, really strange. The detective who made the tape testified in this hearing that he couldn't recall how the edit got there, but that contradicts what he said in the original trial when he testified that he pressed the wrong button while showing it to Jones's defense attorney back in 1986. And Jones's current lawyers had two expert witnesses testify, and they said that that edit couldn't have gotten there by accident.
And do we have any idea of what might have been edited out?
Ooh, well, we kind of do. There was another detective taking notes during the original taping, and those notes have only come to light now. And it seems that what was edited out could have been important in the original trial. We don't know exactly what was in there. Had juries seen it, but they didn't.
Right. So, Bruce, what happens next in this case? Where does it go from here?
Boy, I wish I could answer that. I'm not sure. And no one else really is, Anthony, because another unusual thing happened in court yesterday. Just as the judge was asking the attorneys what to do with the jurors who didn't show up, Darrell Jones stood up and spoke and kind of supervised everyone, even his own lawyers. And he told the judge that he didn't want to continue pursuing the issue of racial discrimination.
Please, Your Honor, I waive the issue. If I don't get out on that, then so be it. I waive it. But I'm not surrendering this little bit of sense of self I got that I know what happened in here and I can go to sleep and I can deal with it and the world know what happened in here. And I'm not looking for no technicality.
Strange, though. I mean, racial bias is hardly any technicality.
Right.
It seems like he's sort of throwing a wrench into the defense's case, or not.
You know, you're kind of right. It's hard to get into his mind. You know, he's frustrated. All he's wanted to do is be heard. And, and now this is coming up in this technicality, what he calls a technicality. He wants to get to the crux of the matter. You know, in this case, yeah, you know, he'd have to make a formal withdrawal of his motion. And I spoke with him earlier today on the phone, and he feels really committed that this case be judged really on the facts of the original trial. I mean, put yourself in his position, you know, you could hear it in his voice. He's frustrated. He's tired. He's been in prison for 30 years. He's serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole for a crime that he insists he didn't do. And so much of the testimony and evidence in the original trial is contradictory. It's weak. It's tainted. His trial, I got to tell you, Anthony, his trial was lacking in so many ways. Let me give you an example. You know, you cited some in the introduction. There was not one eyewitness who could ID Jones in court. All had described the assailant as 6 inches or a foot shorter than the victim. But Jones and the victim were just 1 inch apart. And, you know, I've got the photos lineups that show that. There was another man who was named as a suspect in the police investigative notes. He had a long rap sheet, but the police never even questioned him. And then halfway through the trial, we learned that the police officers who testified against Jones had all represented by the defense attorney, which was bizarre. And then Jones's lawyer made no attempt to investigate the murder, and he later lost his law license for stealing a client's money. This is not just the system's finest day.
Right. Interesting. And of course, all of these defects that you described are often the elements of cases that go awry. We're not saying necessarily this one did, but these are often the elements of that lead to convictions of people who are innocent.
I think, Anthony, it's a classic. I went in skeptical, but I'll tell you, this thing is really a poorly done trial.
Well, WBUR senior reporter Bruce Gellerman, you can link to his latest story as well to his 5-part series on Darrell Jones at our website, radioboston.org. Bruce, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And just when you think they're starting to fade, they do something exciting like this. Last night, the Red Sox were behind 10-9, down to their last out in the bottom of the ninth against the Cleveland Indians. Two men on base, and catcher Christian Vasquez at the plate.
Deep center. And gone.
And gone. Vasquez knocked it out of the park, his first walk-off home run, and the Red Sox beat the Cleveland Indians 12-10, reclaim first place just ahead of the New York Yankees in the American League East by a half game. And joining us now for our weekly chat about sports is Shira Springer, WBUR Sports and Society reporter. Hi, Shira.
Hello, Anthony.
So let's start with what happened at Fenway Park last night. That was a pretty fun moment.
Oh, it was incredible. I think Xander Bogaerts described the game as a PlayStation game because there was so much back and forth last night. First of all, it starts out with Chris Sale pitching, and you think, oh, this is a gimme. He's going to give you a great start. And of course, he gives up a season high 7 runs. I think 5 of those in the first 2 innings.
And that's unusual.
Very unusual. Yeah. And you can just, you know, Red Sox fans are shaking their heads saying, this is not our night. This is not our night. But back and forth, back and forth. And then there was probably the best catch of the season, but this was not by a Red Sox player. It was by Cleveland center fielder Austin Jackson, leaping grab of what should have been robbed Hanley Ramirez of a home run. And not only did he rob him with leaping grab, tumbled into the bullpen, and it was such a good catch that some of the Red Sox relievers afterwards were saying they wanted to applaud until they realized they came sort of back to consciousness and realized, oh,
wait a minute,
wait a second.
He's with the other team.
And then you have these couple of wild pitches in the bottom of the ninth inning that sets up, you know, the stage for Vasquez. So
it's amazing because Vasquez wasn't even supposed to be in the lineup last night, right?
Yeah, I know. Sandy Leon usually catches Sale.
And what I love is
his sore right knee, and then all of a sudden, you know, Vasquez is getting, you know,
and then he wasn't even supposed to be at bat because Mitch Moreland had struck out third out.
Yes, yes.
And then manages to get to first on a pass ball.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's unbelievable. And it's one of those games that you wonder if you look back, you know, as you're in the playoffs, and it's this magical night last night. And this was sort of like a turning point where everything sort of clicked in and this became a team of destiny, so to speak. You know, somebody should probably knock on some wood at this point after saying that. But yeah, it was one of those magical games last night that could be sort of a propel them to bigger and better things.
Well, we've got other stuff to talk about, but what does your gut tell you here? Because it seems like, you know, they were in first, they've been sort of flirting with staying in first, then they fell below first. The Yankees kind of caught up with them. What's your feeling about this team?
Isn't it with you? My gut's sort of all over the place. I mean, it's just been this roller coaster of a year, but I think if they can stay healthy, I think they have a good chance of playing for, you know, the AL championship. I do think, though, the Astros are probably the team to beat. But, you know, a lot can happen. I mean, it seems like, you know, September, the end of September, the playoffs are close. But really, 2 months is a lot of time in a Major League Baseball season. A lot of time for things to go wrong, a lot of time for players to get injured, and a lot of time for a team like the Red Sox to really get some dominant momentum.
All right. Well, we got to talk about the Olympics because in a break with tradition, the International Olympic Committee announced 2 of the next host cities for the Olympic Games. Paris will host in 2024 and Los Angeles in 2028. Now, Paris and LA were the last cities standing going head-to-head for the 2024 Games after all other rivals, including Boston, by the way, pulled their bids.
This could have been us. We could have been Boston 2028.
So what do you think about that?
Listen, this is what had to be done. The IOC really had no choice. It was backed into a corner. Paris was saying it didn't want to host the 2028 Games. Some of the land they're dedicating for facilities, they have other plans for that they want to get moving on. So they basically said, for us, it's 2024 or bust. And let's be fair, Paris has been on the losing end a number of times. Most recently, they thought they had it in the bag, and then in 2012 for the 2012 Games, and then London pulled it out. So Paris was like, you know, listen, 2024 or we're not in it for 2028. And I think the IOC was standing back looking and saying, man, we have had a run of really bad luck and bad optics when it comes to bid city candidacies. Lots of cities dropping out like Boston did. And so they were coming down to these 2-city races. And sometimes the cities weren't all that attractive. Let's not forget that in 2022, Beijing is going to be hosting the Winter Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was a contest between Beijing and Almaty, Kazakhstan. So, you know, they looked at this. They say, listen, we have two great cities, L.A. and Paris. Let's work it out and let's, you know, negotiate in a way that can make it appealing for both cities.
Yeah.
And that's what they did.
So to what extent do you think there is some, I don't know, regret here in Boston that they that Boston dropped the bid? The Boston Globe was editorializing about this today.
I don't think there should be regret.
Yeah.
Because L.A. is a much different situation than Boston. Let's be clear here. L.A. has a lot of the facilities it needs, the Staples Center, Pauley Pavilion. It has the athletes village already essentially constructed if they use dorms from UCLA and USC. Boston had none of that. This was going to be a much, much bigger undertaking for Boston, much more expensive, much more risky. The risk is a bit mitigated. This will be LA's third time hosting the games. They last hosted in 1984. They know what they're doing. They have facilities. Let's not also forget the Coliseum where the opening ceremonies were held in 1984. So
LA is an Olympic city. Boston has the Freedom Trail. So
exactly.
We should just be happy.
We should. I mean, this was not, I don't think of Boston as an Olympic city. I think they made the right call. It's a much LA is much better suited to host.
All right, let's move on quickly and talk about the NFL. There was a fan forum Monday where NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell answered questions about the link between football and CTE, the brain disease connected to repeated head trauma. Now, sitting next to the commissioner was Jamal Adams, a rookie safety for the New York Jets, who weighed in and said this.
If I had a perfect place to die, I would die on the field. I would be at peace. Literally, I would be at peace.
So what's the reaction to Adams' comments, which are sort of extraordinary?
Well, I think there are two reactions. Obviously, you heard the reaction there. This was a fan forum, and you actually had people applauding him saying this. And again, this was in the wake of that CTE study and in the wake of so many veteran football players, you know, retired veterans coming out and saying, listen, I have depression, I have dementia, I have severe memory loss. It's because of head trauma suffered, or what they believe is because of head trauma suffered during their NFL careers. So I think there was sort of this mixed reaction. You have people there and you have fans that are sort of almost blinded to the effects of, you know, later in life that these players are suffering through. And I think, though, on the sort of the sports pundit side, there was a lot of like, this is not the image that the NFL wants to be portraying. They're trying, you know, Goodell is trying to say that, you know, they have rules in place that are making the game safer, and they are trying to increase the self-reporting of concussions and trying to get rid of this culture where players sort of just accept concussions and injuries as part of the game.
And if it's going to kill you, hey, what better place to die than the gridiron? What was Goodell's response here?
He didn't really respond that strongly. He basically emphasized the fact that they're putting more rules in place to make the game safer. He didn't talk about the most recent CTE study results. He sort of just tried to push it aside, which is kind of the NFL's modus operandi when it comes to these things.
All right, really interesting. Shira Springer is WBUR sports and society reporter. Thanks for being with us today, Shira.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And now, a big debate in the world of education about how best to teach non-English-speaking students in Massachusetts schools. 15 years ago, Massachusetts voters replaced bilingual education with English only, or something called sheltered English immersion. The idea was to offer kids the best path to succeed in a culture where English is the dominant language. But now Beacon Hill lawmakers are pushing a bill that would allow school districts more flexibility to bring back bilingual education. But there's a lot of debate about the merits of the plan and about whether sheltered English immersion works. Joining us now with two views on this are Rosalie Porter. She's a former bilingual education teacher and a former head of the bilingual department for Newton Public Schools. She spearheaded the 2002 English-only ballot initiative and says the current system is working. And Rosalie Porter joins us from New England Public Radio in Springfield. Good to have you, Rosalie Porter. Thank you for being with us.
Good to be here, Anthony. Thank you.
Also with us is Miren Uriarte. She's a professor emeritus at UMass Boston and has researched this issue for years. She's a member of the Boston Public School Committee and favors giving schools more leeway on this issue. And Miren Uriarte, welcome to you. It's good to have you.
Thank you.
So let me start with you, Rosalie Porter, if I could. Why do you think the state shouldn't change the current law?
Because the elements are in the present law. When we passed this English immersion law, we allowed parents to ask for a bilingual program if they wanted it. But the main thrust of this law was to give children access to the English language as quickly and effectively as possible. As a former teacher, I believe in it.
Yeah. And you have a bit of a personal story to tell about learning English in the classroom. So your view is very much shaped by your own experience. Can you tell us, give us a little bit of your background and your personal views about this?
Well, briefly, I arrived in the U.S. as a six-year-old child in a family where no one knew a word of English. I sat in a classroom in Newark, New Jersey. Nobody helped me at all. And when I grew up and heard about bilingual education, I thought, this is what I want to do.
Yeah, right.
And I began my career as a teacher, and then I became a researcher and all that stuff.
And before I go over to...
I have a lot of concerns about the idea that English immersion is not effective because it has been proven effective in California, Arizona, and I trust in Massachusetts as well.
So tell us what exactly we mean. I mean, let's define the term sheltered English immersion. I mean, we all understand the idea of English only as a concept, but how is this actually carried out? What does sheltered English immersion actually consist of?
Structured English immersion requires teachers trained in how to teach a language from the very first day of school to teach children how to use the language in social and academic situations, teach them how to do math in English, how to do science in English. And believe me, we have developed very good strategies over the past 30 years. We really know how to do it well. And it's about inclusion. It's about getting these kids in a year or two into a mainstream classroom where they can work with their English teaching
All right.
classmates.
So, Rosalie,
that's
what it's about. Rosalie Porter, I want to come over to you and get a different point of view. You have concerns about English immersion. I'm sorry, Miren Uriarte, I want to come over to you and get your concerns about English-only immersion. Why isn't it working?
Well, I think that the issue here is not... the state has had now 15 years to implement and try different approaches to SEI. And in fact, Massachusetts students are among, the ELLs are among the most accomplished, across the nation. This is not only because of SEI, but because Massachusetts has very good schools in general. I mean, we know they're number one in the United States, as has been found. But so that it is hard at this point to really, sort of isolate the effect of SEI. The issue here is not whether it's an up and down or SEI. It's about the populations of students that we have, the diversity of these students, and the diversity of needs, and the need and the capacity at this point of the districts to really respond to those needs. We have students coming without any formal schooling at all. We have students coming that are very strong in their first language and everything in between, so that the districts have to be able to respond to that reality. And the current system does not allow us to do it. It gives us one recipe for everybody. I think Dr. Porter is correct. Parents can, submit and can, if there are 20 parents in a district, in a grade, they can request a specific exemption. But those things are very hard for immigrant parents to do. And number two, it is almost impossible for a district to respond for every 20, you know, group of 20 students, so that it becomes a non-choice.
True. So
you see what I mean? It becomes a non-choice. So
right.
What we're talking about here is not so much about the negative points of SEI, but about the need to really expand the tools, the capacities of the different districts to respond to the students in front of them.
So, Professor Uriarte, can you give me a sense of what the proposals on Beacon Hill would do that? I mean, is this a question of reinstating bilingual education, or giving individual school districts new flexibility to do whatever they see fit? I mean, how do you describe
what I see is a ladder. It's they would still have to, you know, there would be some requirement for exemption. Yeah, I mean, this is not undoing the law altogether, but it will require some exemptions, but it will allow for much more flexibility and much more innovation at this point than is allowed by current law.
Right. Now, Rosalie Porter, I want to come over to you and just throw some facts at you, because the proponents of changing this law will point to facts like these. English language learners have the highest dropout rates and lowest graduation rates of all subgroups tracked by the state. And folks will say,
doesn't that suggest this is unusual?
Okay, well, explain that, because some folks might look at that and say this is evidence for the need for change.
I'm very disappointed, because it is not unusual for ELL children to have a high dropout rate. Clearly, the state has not done enough to implement the English immersion programs as they should. The results in California and Arizona have been outstanding over the same period of time, reducing dropout rates, improving the students' ability to take state tests in English, et cetera, et cetera. What Professor Maria Uriarte just said is very true. We have a very diverse population from perhaps 50 or 60 different language backgrounds. You cannot give all these children native language instruction, but we do know how to teach them English for academic purposes. I don't know that this state has produced research evidence that English immersion programs are not working here. Maybe they're not doing enough, but I do not see Massachusetts being a depressing state for English language learners.
I mean, I think this is one of the problems and one of the challenges in this debate. From the research that I've done and the help I've gotten from my producer on this segment, it looks like the state hasn't evaluated, done a sort of broad statewide evaluation of whether the current system is working. Is that fair?
That's a big problem.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you for
making
that point, Anthony. That is a huge problem, and it should have been done during the years that we had bilingual programs. It wasn't done for 30 years.
Yeah.
15 years of this new program, new efforts, other states report achievement. This state has not done enough.
So, Mira Nuriarte, what do you have to say about that? You've looked into this a little bit, right?
Yes.
You've done research on this. What have you found?
I think it's correct that we don't have a consistent evaluation at the state level, but there have been studies in Boston, there have been studies in Worcester and Springfield. These are the larger, sites for presence of English language learners. So we do have an idea of what happened. I was part of the research team that looked at Boston, and for example, we saw how the shift from transitional bilingual education to SEI raised, in 3 years, there was a dramatic rise in the number of dropouts. I don't agree with Dr. Porter that it's a natural phenomenon for English language learners to drop out. I think it's natural to expect that their MCAS scores are going to be lower, but there should be, there are ways, and it's not a given that students will drop out in the numbers, in the very high numbers in which they do. I think the graduation rate for English language learners in Massachusetts in the 60 percentile, which is dramatically low. But what I wanted to point out is that in the time since you know, the implementation of SEI in 2003, there have been several, the federal government has had to intervene in Boston, in Worcester, and now at the state level in terms of the training of teachers. In Boston, for example, we're now, since 2009, we're under the oversight of both the Department of Education and the Office for Civil Rights.
But Professor Uriarte, let me jump in on that because this is a question I wanted to ask you. Does that mean, is the problem the law or is it the implementation? In other words, do teachers need to be more properly trained to sort of execute what this law requires?
I think that's going to be the case under any circumstances. And what happened with this law initially is that the assumption was that the switch could be made very easily. That if you, you know, if you can teach one, you know, a student that speaks English, you can also teach a student that does not. And that's just not the case. It requires a lot of professional development of teachers. And the state did not take that on until very, very late. It is now under federal oversight also for the training of teachers. Mm. And it's remedying remedying the situation of teacher, the professional development of teachers. But that has happened in, you know, probably in the last 4 or 5 years. So yes, it is a problem of implementation. But at this point, I think that what those people on the ground and, you know, people that are parents, what we want is the capacity, what people want is the capacity to really innovate and try to see. I mean, what I'm hoping is that we don't, and I'm sure Dr. Porter will agree with me, no one wants to go back to, you know, to the old, you
the
know,
old way. Well, let me get Rosalie.
I think we need something now with that. Let me just make one more point. There is far more experience today in Massachusetts in working with immigrant students than there was in 2001. And I think that's going to be a major, you know, it allows for much more creativity and much more innovation if we give teachers and districts and principals the capacity to do so. I have faith that it will be a good way.
All right, I'm going to jump in here because I want to give Rosalie Porter a chance to respond to that. So, I mean, Rosalie, for what I'm taking away from what Miren Uriarte is saying is, why not allow school districts to choose the type of program that works for their student populations? Give them that ability to innovate and adapt a program that works for them.
Innovation, creativity, all wonderful, provided they meet the basic concern of helping these students into the mainstream. That is the key. And I was happy to hear Dr. Uriarte say that they are doing more teacher training. And I know that Boston has been under federal complaint about they are not having done enough. Let's face it. There was a Supreme Court decision in the Flores versus Arizona case, and one of my favorite justices wrote an opinion, Justice Breyer, in which he said, Spanish-speaking children have the right to be taught the common language of this country so they can succeed in school. He also said, English immersion has proven to be the most effective model. He recognized me by name, which was wonderful. But, you know, I will sit still and applaud any innovation, any creativity in any school district in this state that helps children acquire the English language, fit into regular classrooms, be included, and feel good about what they're doing in school. I've seen this happen in Arizona. Big time. I've seen it happen in California.
Right.
I believe much better things are happening today for limited English children than were happening 30 or 40 years ago.
Well, so let me
and
put
I
that.
And I hope it will continue.
And you
to
hope
improve.
It will continue. So, Miren Uriarte, let me ask you this: would this law that's being considered by the legislature essentially take Massachusetts back to where it was before the voter-approved law? And, respond to Rosalie Porter's concern that the progress has been made since then.
I'm hopeful that it won't, you know what I mean? But I think that it will, you know, the proof is in the pudding and it will be in the implementation of the new law, just as the problems of SEI were in the implementation, so that we need to be vigilant. And I, you know, again, I think that we can all agree that we need to find, we have a very much more complex population of immigrant students right now that require a variety of interventions, not just one type. And I think what we can applaud about this new effort is that it will give districts the capacity to really respond to the individual, you know, to the needs of the different groups of students. And I think that's a good thing.
Mm. And Rosalie Porter, is that your biggest concern, what I sort of expressed in that question to Mirren, and that is that this law would take Massachusetts back to where it was before the voter-approved law in 2002?
I hope, I sincerely and devoutly hope that is not the case. But let me say this. Where school districts, and I'm talking about New York City, where I've been involved in a lawsuit there, where school districts dictate and base some of their decisions on expanding staff, hiring more teachers, doing this and that, and their first concern is not the students' achievement, bad things happen. I know that our population of English learners is very diverse. We have always had a diverse population. We've had mostly children of poverty, families that move frequently from one town to another. The problems of educating these children are large,
and they're complex. And this is a large and complex debate, and I'm afraid we're out of time. So I'm going to thank you both. Rosalie Porter, spearhead of the 2002 ballot initiative, which mandated English immersion. And she is board chair of the organization Pro English, which advocates for English immersion programs. Rosalie Porter, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And Mirren Uriarte, professor emeritus at UMass Boston, member of the Boston Public School Committee. Thank you as well, Professor Uriarte. Good to have you.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us, listeners. Coming up, George Wein, founder of the Newport Jazz Festival, recalls the summer of 1955 when Miles Davis stole the show. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I have another listing here of a group that's coming up. These gentlemen live in the realm that Buck Rogers is trying to reach.
The Newport Jazz Festival gets underway this coming weekend with performances by Bella Fleck, The Roots, the Branford Marsalis Quartet, and the Christian McBride Big Band, to name just a few. But we wanted to listen back to a key moment at Newport from 1955.
And then we go on down to Miles Davis, trumpet. Miles Davis.
That's jazz legend Duke Ellington introducing Miles Davis before his first appearance at the festival. It's from a collection of Davis's performances at Newport released two summers ago when I spoke to jazz impresario George Wein, the founder of the festival, who will turn 92 in October. We talked about Miles Davis's evolution as a musician, beginning with that first amazing performance at Newport. 61 years ago, Miles Davis took the stage at Newport for the first time and performed Thelonious Monk's Round Midnight. It was 1955, early days for the Jazz Festival. George Wein, who was then and remains today at the age of 91, the driving force behind the festival, recalls that memorable performance.
The sound system was terrible that year. Remember, this is the second year of the festival, and we hadn't really developed our technical abilities yet. And Miles put the bell of his horn right in the microphone and overcame the bad sound that some of the bands had to put up with.
This solo stole the show, and it earned Miles Davis a deal with Columbia Records. But as George Wein recalls, this performance would never have taken place if not for a chance encounter with Miles Davis earlier that year.
I was in a club in New York. Walking out of the club, Miles is there. And he says, George, you're going to have a jazz festival this year? I says, yes. He said, well, you can't have a festival without me, Miles says. So, and Miles used to like to repeat statements all the time, you can't have a festival without me. So I called his agent. I brought him up to Newport. He wasn't even advertised. He didn't have a band. Thelonious Monk didn't have a band. Jerry Mulligan didn't have a band. And Connie Kay and Percy Heath were with the Modern Jazz Quartet. So I put this group together, and they just jammed. And they played Round Midnight, and it destroyed the audience.
This version of Round Midnight is part of a new collection of Miles Davis's performances at the festival called Miles Davis at Newport, 1955 to 1975, the Bootleg Series Volume 4. It includes 4 hours of previously unreleased recordings.
Miles, in his book, writes that he used a mute in that solo. And as you can hear now, it was with an open horn. And for some reason or other, Miles remembered that he had a mute. The sound is beautiful now.
George Wein, I'd love it if you could tell the story. So Miles Davis comes off the stage after that performance. A lot of people are paying attention to him now. And he has something to say about the way Thelonious Monk played that, right?
Well, Miles comes up to me and says, tell Thelonious he plays the wrong changes in Round Midnight. I says, Miles, he wrote the song. What are you going to do? I mean, that's exactly the way the world was in that time in jazz. People developed their own sense of improvisation and what they felt comfortable with.
Now, did you know, George Wein, at that moment that you were seeing a historic performance that's been remembered for so long?
I think I did, because what it meant was, for the first time, one of the great trumpet players that emerged out of the bebop era wasn't playing bebop. All the trumpet players were more or less in the Dizzy Gillespie mold. And Miles was the first one to break that mold. And we played the melody on Round Midnight. He just gave it the most beautiful interpretation, very traditional interpretation, even though it was very modern in its actual performance.
Well, I want to ask you about some of the great moments in this collection. Miles Davis came back to Newport in 1958. By then, he's a much bigger star. He's a best-selling artist. He was performing with a sextet that included John Coltrane. So let's listen to his number, Alu Cha. What struck you then about how he had changed, how he was developing as an artist?
Miles was like a chameleon. He absorbed what was happening around him. And he knew that everybody was talking about Cannonball, and there was beginning to be talk about Coltrane. And, of course, Coltrane eventually took over the whole music scene. But at that time, it was all experimenting. And Miles was listening to Coltrane. Miles said to Coltrane, Why do you play so long? Why do you play so many choruses? He says, I don't know. I just seem to keep playing. And Miles says, why don't you try taking the horn out of your mouth? So all of these things. And, of course, Cannonball was a swinger in the Bird tradition. And it was a great band. It was a fantastic band, you know.
Well, there's great live energy in these recordings, isn't there? I mean, listening back, how do these live recordings give a different appreciation of these guys?
Musicians respond to an audience. And if they went into a hall that night and the people were waiting for them, and the minute they started to play, they could feel the energy in the audience, they responded with the music. And that's exactly what happened with most of these tapes.
So, George Wein, 1969 was a big year for the festival. Tell me about that.
I had all the rock groups on that festival because jazz was at a very low ebb, and I figured that I had to do something to keep the festival au courant, so to speak. And Miles stayed around the whole festival when he normally would just come, play, and leave as fast as he could, he stayed around right at my shoulder for two nights, and he saw the response of the audience, and that's when he decided, when he started to play again, to go into a more electronic scene, which he did in the last few years of his life. That's all he played.
Well, speaking of that, so here's a recording of Davis playing Bitches Brew in 1971 at the Newport Jazz Festival in Europe. So let's listen to a bit of this. Bitches Brew was a big moment for jazz. As you mentioned, it was already happening before, but Miles is beginning to fuse jazz with non-jazz elements, and a lot of folks sort of accused him of selling out. What was your take?
I loved the early Miles because the purity of his trumpet was so beautiful. I mean, there was nothing more beautiful in jazz at that time. But the people liked what he was doing, and he enjoyed doing what he was doing. It made it easier on him because he could lean on the rhythm and lean on the sounds of the orchestra, where before he had to carry everything else by himself, just with his horn. And you can hear the difference. So to say sold out is a strange thing. He always wanted to change with the times. And he was just paying attention to that.
What's it like for you to hear these recordings again, all these years later?
Well, my life is two things. A life of memories, which I try not to get too involved with, but everybody's asking me about my memories. But really, I'm concerned with the future. I'm 90 years old. I'll be 90 in October. But I spend my time wondering about what's going to happen with jazz. There's thousands and thousands of young people playing jazz that come out of schools having studied jazz. So far, we're still leaning on the history of the music. At the same time, you have some people that have evolved into commercial acceptance, like John Batiste. John Batiste, a fantastic musician, and his music communicates.
I went down to St. James Infirmary, and I saw my baby lying there.
Whether he's the one that's the future of jazz, that's another story, but he will be around and a popular figure in jazz for years to come. But I hope I live long enough to see some of the things I dream of.
What has kept you so attached to this music for so long?
I guess I got bit by it when I was about 14 years old, and this bite has lasted. I could have been a major rock promoter and made a lot more money than I've made, but I found out that I'm happy when I was creating my festivals. And musicians cooperated with me, and we created history, like Miles, like Duke Wynton playing with Tony Bennett just a few years ago, and also working with Dave Brubeck on one of his last concerts. There's hundreds of these memorable moments over the years at different festivals, and I enjoy that. I didn't want to just service the groups. I wanted to be involved in producing an event and not just put on a star because they sold a lot of tickets. I could have done that. I've done that when I had to do it. But my love is creating as much as it's possible within the structure of what a festival gives us.
Well, George Wein, it's such a pleasure to talk to you and to hear you express the passion that has been there for so many years. That's George Wein. He's co-founder of the Newport Jazz Festival. And George Wein, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And if you come out to Newport, I'll be driving around in my Wein machine so you can say hello to me. I'd love it.
All right, we'd love that. We recorded that conversation with George Wein back in 2015. This year's Newport Jazz Festival kicks off on Friday. You can find out, you can find more information about that and about that special Miles Davis at Newport collection at RadioBoston.org. That's it for today. Our program is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.